It's Richard Mackey with the UBC Law History Project. It's the 8th of January 2013, and I'm in North Vancouver at Bill Ferguson's house. Bill, welcome to the project.
Thank you.
We were talking before the interview about your origins on Vancouver Island, which was very interesting to me because I've written these two books about logging, the logging history of the island, and that ties into Cumberland and into Bevan. So I thought that would be a nice place to start. If you could mention your early life, your parents, your childhood, that'd be great.
Actually, it starts before Vancouver Island because I was born in Coal Creek, that's C-O-A-L, and that was a town that once existed outside of Fernie, which was a coal mining town. And I moved from there as an infant, I suppose, when the mine shut down. And a lot of people moved to the Cumberland area around that time or when the mine was shutting down. So actually, the town was around long enough that my father was born in Coal Creek, too. We first lived in Puntledge, which was called Number 8, and it was because of the Number 8 mine there. And I think I was probably still living in Puntledge when I started school at the two-room Bevan school. And I went there till about grade 4 or 5, and then we moved to Cumberland and finished my schooling there. And I graduated from Cumberland Junior Senior High in 1962, which was the year the school shut down and became a junior high after that. There are a number of schools throughout the province, that high schools that were shut down in 1962. Coincidentally, my wife graduated from King Ed in Vancouver in 62, and that King Ed High School shut down in 62 as well. Became a junior college or something after that.
There had been a baby boom. You'd think that they would need all extra schools.
Well, we were pre-baby boom. I was born in 43, she was born in 44, so the baby boom was a couple years later. And it was just some kind of provincial reorganization. I know in the Comox Valley there was a Solom High School that shut down the same year, and everyone was bused to high school into Courtney High School. My parents on both sides coal mining families. My father, as I mentioned, was born in Coal Creek. His folks came from Cumberland, England, the county, and my mother was born in Cumberland, England. So a lot of people who ended up in Cumberland, B.C., just by coincidence, got their origins in the coal mining areas of Cumberland, England.
What was your mom's name?
Her name was Shilton. And she was one of seven children. Four were born in England, and three were born in Canada. My grandfather, Tom Shilton, was a soldier. So he had children around the time of the First World War, and then had some later. So he came out to the Fernie area without my grandma, but she packed the kids up one year and came out and joined them. And so he lived up camp in Cumberland. I lived up camp in Cumberland, which was a good, easy walk to the school. And I had a couple of aunts and uncles that lived up camp too. One of the highlights of school was, for at least one year, my mother ran the local fish and chip store, so I'd go home with lunch for hamburgers and chips, and then back to school. Not many people in my family had gone far in school. My mother got mad at the teacher and quit when she was in grade 5. And my father, who I never really knew because they separated when I was an infant, I don't know how far he went, but it wouldn't have been any more than grade 8. My stepfather, who was originally from Glasgow, quite bright. He went to grade 8, but that was standard to drop out of school in grade 8. My older sister, who was just 2.5 years older than me, went to grade 7 and my younger sister went to grade 8. So there weren't many people that carried on an education, but to me it was a bit of a refuge of some sort. And once I got through elementary school, I became keen on going to school. So for some reason I hung in there. In high school, I'd been in the militia for a couple of years, in the Canadian Scottish, and my two goals I thought about was one, joining the RCMP, or the other was joining the Army. And so I applied to regular officer training, ROTP, and was accepted. I got a telegram saying you're accepted, but not to College Militaire Royal Saint-Jean, which was the only one that took you after grade 12, but to any university of your choice. So I was working in Vancouver that summer at Jericho Beach as a sergeant in the militia. I went out to UBC and said, here I am. And they said, well, you have to apply. And I said, well, here's my telegram. And they said, no, you've got to apply. So I said, well, how do you go about doing that? And because I'd never even given a university a thought, apart from military college. And they handed me a thick calendar and told me to pick some courses and make an application. And so I ended up going to UBC, started out in a boarding house, and then over the next couple of years, shared space with a couple of other students, and ended up in a basement suite in my fourth year by myself. And I enjoyed the learning experience. I started out in science because I thought that was what the military would have required of me. And I got good marks in science, but realized after first year I wasn't that interested, and switched to political science and economics. I was on the combined honors program. Had a great time in university. Went back east with the Army every summer. And just around Christmas time in my fourth year, I dropped out of university. I'd had enough, I guess. I got ill and decided to just walk away from university. So I didn't do my final exams. And I got a job in Kitimat, and they give me bus fare. And then before I went up there, I phoned home and said to my mother, you know, can I come home? I don't know why I had to ask. Of course I could go home. And she said, yeah. And of course she said, yeah. And she knew I was looking for a job, but she didn't want me to go logging because she always thought logging was too dangerous. And she spotted there was a job for assistant manager at Niagara Finance in Courtney in the local newspaper, which meant you're the trainee because it was just Harry and the secretary and then the assistant manager. And I started working there, and I found it very relaxing to have a 9-to-5 job. It was there was so much freedom compared to being a soldier or a student. And it was, you had some income. I bought a used Volkswagen Beetle, went hunting and fishing, and joined the Cumberland Kinsmen for a little bit. And I liked the idea of working in a regular life, and I didn't know what to do. I don't know where the idea of applying to law school came up. I remember once when I was an undergrad, I met a couple of law students, and they seemed to be smartly dressed, which didn't matter one way or the other, but they said, well, law school was hard. I didn't really give it any thought, but for some reason when I was looking for permanent employment and I'd have to learn a trade or a profession, I thought of law school.
Did you know any of the lawyers in Courtney?
No, I didn't know any lawyers anywhere. So I knew I couldn't make enough money at the Niagara Finance. I'd applied for a job of manager of, I think it was parent company of Niagara at the time in Nanaimo, but I didn't get it, which is probably a good thing. So I went north to make my fortune. I went to the Peace River, drove my Volkswagen Beetle up there. There was dam construction going on, and I showed up at the site and said, here I am. And they said, well, you have to belong to the union. and I wasn't worldly wise, so I didn't know, you know, to bribe or whatever you did to get a union job. But I was up there anyway, and a friend of my uncle had an appliance store in Dawson Creek. I went and looked him up, and he said, well, my partner's just opening a store in Fort St. John. So he may be able to take you on. I drove up to Fort St. John, and the guy said, yeah, he could hire me. It was just about store opening. And at the end, he hired me that day. And at the end of the day, I asked him if I could sleep in the back of the store. And he said, well, you know, come home. I've got a wife and a couple of kids. Come home and stay with us. So I knew I wouldn't make enough money for law school doing that all summer. And I ended up with West Coast Transmission, working about 100 miles north of Fort St. John, painting pipe for the summer. And then I found out I'd been accepted to law school. In those days, and probably even now, you don't need a degree if you qualify, under those days' standards anyway. And there was no LSAT in those days, and that becomes a part of my history down the road too. So I was still short of funds, but my stepdad's brother and his wife said I could live with them in North Van. I didn't have to pay room and board. And my stepdad loaned me $1,000, which was really out of character from when he was from the harder times in the 50s and 60s. So anyway, I went off to law school.
And was he a Ferguson?
No, his name was Pete Queen. He was he came over from Scotland when he was a young man with his mom and dad. They lived in the Comox Valley, had a bit of a strawberry farm and a goat. And so I started law school, and it was 1967, and that was probably the most exciting. I've often thought, and I've mentioned, it's probably those 3 years from 67 to 70 were probably the best years for anybody to go to law school in BC. The stories we'd heard about before then was pretty strict, rigid kind of place, where even there were suicides. 67 to 70 was sort of the dawning of free thinking, and you know, it was very a casual kind of era. Even for, well, it was like all over the world, it was a pretty exciting time. My attitude about law school was different than a lot of my classmates. I went there for vocational training. Now, you don't get vocational training, but in my mind, you did. I made the decision I wanted to have a job, a profession, because of the experience, my past experience. And I decided I would go there and learn everything I could. Now, it's academic and it's not academic. It's really not a place where you go and study the way you would an academic study in history or philosophy or chemistry or physics. It's the practice of law is problem solving. And if you can recognize the issue so you know what, for sure what the problem was and can learn the legal cases and whatnot and legal theories and apply them to the answer, then you can excel in law school. A lot of first class students from other backgrounds didn't do well in law school, and some of them even failed because they guess they were looking for a similar type of academic training that they'd experienced in the past. And I used to mentor a couple of them and say, you know, what's really important is identifying the issue and putting down the answer. In any event, it worked for me, and
so it was a practical. You saw it as a practical.
I saw it as practical. I was there to learn a trade, a profession, and I went to class. The main thing I did to do well in law school, and I didn't know at the time I was going to do so well, was to attend classes. I figured if I could, I figured that was a good way to learn, and it was. And a lot of my classmates were casual about class. Some of them weren't interested in law school. Some of them were interested, but just only cared if theirs got by. But I was trying to learn everything I could. But at the same time, I probably had more fun at law school and socially than anybody. I met my wife right at the beginning of first year.
Was she a law student too?
No. In those days, there were very few women. I think there were 7 in our class, you know, instead of the 50 or 55% that's in there now. No, she'd been at Vancouver School of Arts for 4 years, which became Emily Carr, and she was a potter. But she couldn't make a living as a potter, and she was able to use those 4 years to get some credit towards an elementary teaching degree at UBC, and she went there for a couple of years. So she was attending UBC, and I met her near the beginning of first year law, and we were married within a year. We were married the following October, when I at the beginning of second year law. As soon as she had a salary, we couldn't get married until she had a salary.
Did you meet her through the social event at law school?
No. A friend of mine who I'd roomed with right from first year arts, he dropped out. He was a mining type. And he eventually went back and finished his mining degree, but he was coming down from Merida someplace where he was working, and he was dating her at the time. And I think he was neglecting her a bit. In any event, we hit it off pretty quickly. Decided within a month or so we were going to get married, and we did. Her dad was a police inspector in Vancouver. She became an elementary school teacher. Our first date was the very first Shrum Bowl between SFU and UBC. Her cousin Bob Smith and his friends were playing for Simon Fraser. So I enjoyed the studies. I enjoyed the camaraderie. I really enjoyed the social life. I enjoyed everything about going to law school. I didn't know I'd done so well until before the marks came out at the end of first year. I was out at a speech by Lord Denning, who is sort of a guru for UBC law. Everyone relate to Lord Denning, and he was out speaking. And Tony Hickling came up to me, and he said, "Bill, they referred your exam back to me a couple of times. I wanted to give you a higher... They wanted me to look at your marks. It was sort of in line with the other marks you got that they wanted me to re-examine it. But, you know, you even answered questions on the exam that we didn't cover in class, and I wouldn't give you a higher mark." And I thought, gee, I must have done really well then, because if his mark was 20% lower than my next lowest mark. So I was pretty tickled pink by that. And it turned out I came, I think it was 5th in first year law, which was great. I whatever background I had or inclination I had, higher marks than I got as an undergrad. So I was quite pleased with that.
What was the first year curriculum?
It was, in those days, you didn't get much choice. You took constitutional law for the year, contracts for the year, torts for the year. I think you took torts in first year. Legal institutions, I think, is what Tony taught, and that was for a year. And it was a silly course that no one wanted to pay much attention to, because it was dealing with... Here again, I said I went there for vocation, but it was dealing with things like court rules and whatnot, which you can't really learn until you're articling or downtown practicing them. But I was serious about every class, and probably paid more attention in his class than any other than anyone else did, but in any event, the exam didn't go the way the other exams went. But I was kind of pleased. I was really pleased that I'd done so well. I worked in swimming pool construction in the summer. And I think it was at the start of second year, where I got married in October. But that's when I also got involved in politics. By way of protest, I decided to run for Senate. And it was the second time senators were being elected on the campus. And my protest was different than the protest of the student radicals. My protest was against the blind following. Around 68, everybody was kissing their butts. You could hear a pin drop if somebody like Carrie Lind or Stan Persky was speaking to an assembly in the law faculty. But they were saying the most absurd things. And if I'd raise my hand to ask a question, people like J.J. Camp and Abel Kuzaki, who were part of the student politics, would sort of look at me as if to say, well, you know, we're revering what's going on right now. And so I thought, well, I had to do something about it, so I thought I'd run for Senate. And my platform was, if I recall correctly, was things like, you know, if you're supposed to follow a pig into the faculty club, you should ask why. It didn't make any sense to me, and it didn't make any sense to me that students should be picking the curricula instead of the professors. And also, I thought it'd be easy to get elected because apathy was very prevalent in those days. And I figured if I got the engineering faculty behind me and campaigned in the student residence, then it would be a no-brainer, and it turned out to be the case. The engineering faculty, I went and spoke to the executive. I had a very close friend who was an engineer, and got their support. And I'd go to the dining room at the student residence and stand up on the table and get their attention at dinner time and whatnot. So Stu Rush got elected too, and Stu was, I guess, a representative of the other side. I didn't have a side, although I did have some support to get elected. It was just ask why before you. But the pendulum was swinging so far to the favor of the student radicals in those days, it wasn't popular to ask them why. Mm-hmm. Once
it
I got.
Was an orthodoxy.
Yeah. Once I got elected, I realized I didn't really want to be on the Senate, but I had 2 years to serve, and I think I served it well and did the best I could, and the students were shown respect by the rest of the Senate, and I was on various committees that were important, like one to seek and select a new president for the university or something like that. It might have been the Faculty Arts, but I think it was the university. But I'd made my point.
Was there any power attached to being on the Senate, or was it more of a token? Token, yeah.
There was power in the sense that you got to vote it, and you had your committee votes, and I started to smile when you said that, because years later I'm remembered by a couple of my classmates as the guy who brought in LSAT, which... They kiddingly condemned me for. But I was convinced, I guess, I must have been, I don't know if I was on a committee, but there were so many people applying to law school, and marks, you know, a lot of them with good marks, and I became convinced that they needed an additional means of determining who gets in, and if it was based on, you know, problem solving or applied common sense or something like that, then I guess I got convinced that it was, so I supported it and voted in favor of it. I've heard many comments over the years from my classmates that a lot of us wouldn't have got into law school if we'd had to do LSATs.
I think I've heard that from pretty well everyone I've interviewed who predates the LSAT era.
I'm not sure we're correct though on that. I think we have the impression there's a lot of homogenous, non-rebellious people went to law school after we did, and our types wouldn't have got in. But I'm not so sure. I think you have to give some credit to the people who followed afterwards, and I don't think they changed as much as the system changed. We had a 67 to 70 was a unusual time, and I think law school became more conservative. I know it became more conservative after our time, maybe more quickly than more slowly, and people became more serious and had to, I think the whole system became more serious, except some of the courses in attempt to become, I guess, more practical became airy-fairy. You didn't have to study constitutional law, I don't think. You didn't have to do family and criminal law. You didn't have to. You could do courses that, you know, we thought were namby-pamby, but we weren't there anyway, so. So anyway, I enjoyed second year, and I enjoyed third year, and really enjoyed the social life. When it came to applying for articles, and the idea of practicing law, I still knew nothing about it. There was no interaction that was noticeable between the downtown profession and the students out of the faculty in those days. I think when it came to looking for articles, I talked to my father-in-law, who was the police inspector. He said I should go talk to John Hall, who was a prosecutor at the time. And I think he said, he'd recommend Russell Dumoulin, because he knew some of the guys there, the CFL connections. But I had won, I only got one award for first year, and it was the $50 Leon Ladner book prize. So I either thought of it myself or my father-in-law or somebody suggested I go thank Leon Ladner. And I did. And I was talking to Sid Cross or Dave Vickers or somebody there. And this was before the formal, it wasn't very formal in those days, but this was before the formal time for interviews. And I indicated I'd like to article there. And I didn't want to wait for interviews. And they said fine. And so I had that out of the way and didn't have to disrupt my summer for looking for an articling position. My mother has always said, if you don't ask, you don't get. So I don't know where I got the confidence, but I had that kind of confidence. So I did my articles at Ladner Downs and I stayed there for another year and a third, and then I joined a small firm which was called Fraser, Hyman, DeFosse and Gifford, and I was the fifth lawyer. That, to make a long story short, that firm later became Ferguson Gifford, which was we grew over 50 lawyers at one time, but we wrapped it up in 1999. But back to the law school, I'm downtown and I'm realizing I severed all contact with the law school. I'd only been practicing for a couple of years. And for some reason I wanted to reconnect. And I phoned Bertie McLean, who was the dean at the time. And he was one of my favorite teachers when I was a student. And I said, Bertie, I'm thinking of doing some part-time teaching at the law school. And he said, well, I know just the course for you to teach. And I said, well, you haven't interviewed me. You haven't, you don't know if I could be a good teacher. And Bertie said, well, I knew you as a student. You want to teach, you can teach. So it wasn't a hard course to teach. It was play school. It was called Trial and Appellate Practice. And later it became called Trial Advocacy, but I did it for 16 years or so. Just every second Monday afternoon or something like that. Maybe only one term. It was a relatively new course, but it was getting downtown judges. I think Hugh McGivern was the first one. He was a provincial court judge at that time. And I don't know if anybody else taught it before me, after you, but I mean, a couple of guys might have. But basically, we did trial problems and play acting in the classroom, where someone would be plaintiff, someone would be defendant's counsel, the students would be witnesses, or small groups, or we'd do some criminal stuff too, if I recall correctly. So that was a nice, it was a nice, my practice was enjoyable, really enjoyable, but it was a nice break to go out to the law school and hang out with the students.
Do you remember any of the students from that time? You keep in touch?
Well, some of them I don't remember, but they remember me. But I haven't, you know, I don't have a list of, but mm-hmm. a lot of this, you know, you get to see these guys and you keep, and they, also you're a contact for them, and I'm sure some of them would come to me for advice on articles and that after that. I eventually passed that off to Al Hudson and Jack Webster, who were young partners of mine at the time, and I think their law firm might still be carrying on the same slot that I started. It was interesting. So now I'm teaching part-time at the faculty. I have faculty club membership. I have faculty parking. And I decided it was time to finish my Bachelor of Arts. So I checked it out, and instead of combined honors, political science and economics, I could get a BA in political science if I took two more courses. I think when I was in law school, I had to take an elective. And I did that for some reason when I was in law school. I think it was Anthropology 200 or 100 or something like that. But I had to take two political science courses to get my BA. So I took, one was the political sociology of violence. And it was outside of the faculty, but it qualified. And the other was BC government and politics. And I think I took them over the period of a year. And that was Jerry Christensen, I think, who taught that. And it was interesting because I think every other student in the class, and there was about 50 or 60, was born after I started my BA in 62. And
this was I think it said 86 on your CV that
you... Yeah, it seems funny. People think it's a misprint because my law degree is in 70. Yeah. And it was 25 years after I started. Maybe it was 87. Anyway, I got my BA, and people asked me why I did it, and I just said, but because I could. I had, you know, full-time secretary, Audrey Oblak, who ended up staying with me for 26 and a half years, so I had someone to type my papers. As I say, I had the club membership and the parking. And I found both courses interesting. And so that's something I took advantage of by teaching part-time at the law school.
Did you ever consider graduate work in political science, or were you by that time into fully established?
No, I used to toy with the idea for the fun of going to some place like Oxford, and as a student, and Bert Schmidt, who was one of my partners in the later part of my career, said that'd be the silly thing to do. Go as a teacher. But I never, I just, there's a little fantasy of maybe living in England for a year at a university. But one thing, I took constitutional law in first year. Noel Lyon was the teacher. And a lot of students didn't pay much attention in class. And Noel was a nice guy. But he had this silly way of teaching called McDougall-Laswell, I think it was called, and it was inputs and outputs with arrows and whatnot. And people were confused by constitutional law, and I thought they were doubly confused by the inputs and outputs. And I would have a discussion with Noel about it. But he liked this theory, and I think he even wrote a book incorporating this theory. But after I finished first year, he approached me and asked me if I would spend the summer working for him, helping him write his book. And I knew I wouldn't make enough money, and I don't know if I said to him or we exchanged correspondence, but I said, why me? You know, I'm the one that criticized your technique. And he said, well, that's why. He said, and also it was my highest mark. I think I got 84% or something in constitutional law. So having had been in political science, I guess constitutional law was an easy course for me, and plus I was interested, and I'm a bit of a Canadian nationalist. Having been in the army, I'd seen a fair bit of the country, spent time in Quebec and Ontario, and just very romantically fond of my country. So I was interested in that stuff. Anyway, I didn't follow up. I turned down the offer. Can we stop for a second?
Sure.
Hello. Hello? Yeah.